I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. This month marks 5 years since the bottom of the financial crisis and the start of Wall Street's bull market. Will it continue? And is it time for investors who've done well to take some chips off the table? Ken Solo joins us this hour, an experienced financial advisor who helped Midday listeners understand the crisis that led to the recession in 2008 and 2009. He also wrote a book on active portfolio management. We'll hear what he has to say about the bull market, the nation's recovery from the recession, and we'll get Ken's reactions to a letter from a Midday listener who suspects market manipulation behind the success of the street's biggest investors. Midday on Money, after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks with you here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF out of Frederick and Hagerstown, and WYPO Ocean City in the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and streaming online to anywhere in the world through WYPR.org. Thank you again, folks, for making Midday part of your day. In the second hour today, David Zurawick will be joining us, the Baltimore Sun's media critic. We'll talk about Josh Charles. He had a conversation with the Baltimore-born actor Josh Charles just the other night after the Baltimore-born actor's role in The Good Wife on CBS ended, shockingly. And lots of folks have been talking about that. So David will be talking about that again in the second hour of the show today. Plus, a look at the expansion of Maryland-based Sinclair Broadcasting. Also, CNN's controversial wall-to-wall coverage of Malaysian Flight 370. And what's the future of House of Cards as a Maryland production? All of that with David Zurawick, the Z on TV, in the second hour of Midday. This month marks the bull market's five-year anniversary. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 149% since March 9th, 2009, which was considered the bottom of the financial crisis. Time flies, and while the general economy seems to poke and stumble along, Wall Street has been having a grand old time. But even as celebrants note the five-year bull market, some of the pros are saying it's time to slow down. How long will the bull market last? Will it continue for the foreseeable future? Is this a time to cash in some chips by selling select shares? And as far as new investments go, what areas are hot and what are not? For this edition of Midday Money, we welcome back to our show Ken Solo, an experienced financial advisor who helped us understand the financial crisis as it unfolded 5 to 6 years ago with several appearances on Midday. Ken is the chairman of the investment committee at Pinnacle Advisory Group, a private wealth management firm that's based in Columbia. Pinnacle manages more than $1.5 billion in assets for 800 families in the Mid-Atlantic. And Ken was here, as I said, a few years ago. It was in 2009, around that time of the bottom of the financial market, the financial crisis, that Ken's book came out, Buy and Hold is Dead Again, in parentheses it was called, The Case for Active Management in Dangerous Markets, a very timely book then, and a lot of the principles in that book we can talk about again today. Ken, nice to have you back on the show.
It's
been a while since we had you here, and it's interesting to note you were here helping us explain along as all of this unfolded. And it seems like yesterday, doesn't it? But 5 years has gone by.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. A lot of folks that I talk to out there are maybe not even understanding or recognizing what the markets have done over the past 5 years. They kind of got stuck in the market decline, in the bear market.
Right.
And they're looking around, and now they have that feeling, wow, did the train leave the station? I wasn't on it. Is it too late to hop on now?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a good time to chat about things.
Well, talk about that a little bit, would you? Because there's a lot of folks listening probably have the impression, yeah, something's been going on there on Wall Street. We know it's good for them. It's not so great for us because the economy seems to be still, like I say, stumbling and poking along here. So what has it been like the last 5 years that we describe as a bull market?
Well, what it's been for, as you mentioned, for stock investors, it's been quite the party. And depending on your level of cynicism, part of that might have to do with the fact that American corporations have done very, very well in terms of their earnings growth. And maybe part of that story is the fact they really haven't invested very much over the past 5 years. A lot of talk about why they haven't, the uncertainties and blaming Washington and how could they invest with the amount of fiscal craziness and that's gone on with budget deadlocks and
shutting down the government,
sequesters, shutting down the government, all that kind of thing. And then the other part of that, again, depending on which side of this you want to take, is just the fact that it doesn't seem as though workers have participated in this very well. And so when labor and wages have kind of been stagnant, that drops very much to corporations' bottom lines. So you have corporate America with lots of cash. And then the last part of that equation is, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, the central bank, which has dropped interest rates to zero and made it a really very, very attractive for corporations to borrow money very cheaply. And again, today, corporate profit margins are at record highs. So there you go.
Let me ask you this. When people say to you that there's this great disconnect, greater than ever, between Wall Street and Main Street, that the reason Wall Street does so well is because of some of the reasons you just mentioned, a lack of investment, sitting on tons of cash, and cutting back, right? Not hiring or cutting back. That's how a lot of people on the street, on Main Street, see it.
Yeah, and I think that, and I'm certainly not here to defend Wall Street in any way, shape, or form. My job is to help people make some money. But mm-hmm. I think that if you understand the cycle and where we came from out of the market bottom, going from 2007 to 2009, where the system was completely broke, I think the bullish case here is that we're getting to a place where consumers are going to begin to really benefit. And we're beginning to see that now with our new Fed chair, Janet Yellen, beginning to talk about where are we in this cycle? Are these structural issues with employment? Or are they just part of this cycle? And again, we're seeing some positive things as the unemployment rate continues to drop. All of a sudden here, all the discussion is, well, maybe interest rates are going to be headed higher soon. Maybe wages are headed higher soon. And maybe we'll get more of an economic cycle, an economic recovery. That's what they call a virtuous cycle.
I want to quote here a couple of sentences from a Wall Street Journal article, Wall Street advising investors, time to cash in some chips, was the headline on the Wall Street Journal story just from a couple of days ago. While the market could keep rising for the foreseeable future, cashing in some chips by selling select shares and being cautious about new investments likely is a wise move. Well, the latter part of that, I think, is always the case. But what about that? Should people be investors? Are investors looking to slow things down a little bit? Has it been too good? And when it's too good, is that when trouble's coming?
Yeah. I mean, I guess when we talk about investors, I'm always leery because for most, I'm guessing most of your listeners, they have an investment policy. They have an asset allocation, X percent of their, at least hopefully, they have some diversified approach to what they're doing with their money. Mm-hmm. So when equity markets are in a bull market like this, a sustained bull market, at a minimum, we would advise everyone to rebalance their portfolio. Because if you were at a mix of 70% stocks and 30% bonds, today you're more likely at 75 or 78% stocks. Mm-hmm. And so just selling back to your regular percentages is a great way to take some profits, take some chips off the table.
Yeah.
But it's not a speculative type of a thing where you're trying to guess where the market top is, where the market bottom is. It's more of a systematic approach to chip taking and chip making. For investment professionals, I mean, I'm a guy who wrote a book called Buy and Hold is Dead Again. Obviously, one of the things you need to be most careful about is, are the financial markets becoming expensive? And how would you measure that? And how would your behavior change if you thought they were expensive?
Well, that's pretty important, isn't it?
It's becoming
harder to invest because it's not cheap.
No. And you know, part of that, I think, is just sensible when the market, I love the price of the S&P at the market low was 666.
666,
of course,
right.
The
yeah.
sign of the devil.
Right,
so right. we've come a long way. When I left the office this morning, the S&P was trading at 1870. So it's been quite the run up. And you would expect that stocks have gotten a lot more expensive. And maybe in terms of their price, they have. But what you need to realize is that earnings have grown just about as fast. So today, I would say that the weight of the evidence says that stocks are certainly more expensive. We would categorize them as expensive, but not yet so expensive that you'd be ringing alarm bells. With the exception of some of the stocks maybe we'll talk about today, which has to do with social media and biotech.
We're going to talk about sectors, yeah. right? Sectors for investing and not specific stocks. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yes,
that's one
yes,
of the rules
yes.
here. But you're allowed to call in, ask a question of Ken Solo while he's with us in this hour of midday. 410-662-8780, no matter what level you're at in terms of income or investment power. If you have a question for Ken Solo, it's a good time to give us a ring. 410-662-8780. Toll-free, long-distance for the midday show in Baltimore is 866-661-9309. And you can reach us by email to midday@wypr.org. Please, your questions for Ken Solo in this hour of the show. I want to read an email that came in that got me reconnected to Ken Solo here. It came from one of our listeners. And Ken's already read this, and so I gave him a little prep on it. This came from one of our listeners, Mr. Webster, who was just, sitting at home wondering about what goes on on Wall Street. And so he wrote me this conspiracy theory that he has. He said, I doubt if you will agree. I don't know why he would say that. But I would like you to consider my theory about the Dow Jones. On January 16th, the Dow was about 16,600. And as of yesterday, he's writing this on February 4th, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
It was 15,372, a drop of 1,228 points. I have a small IRA retirement fund of approximately $112,000 as of January 16th, and as of February 3rd, it dropped to $107,000, okay? That's a loss of $5,379 in just 2 weeks. If you track the Dow over the past year or so, you will see this huge fluctuation many times. Now we're getting to his question. If you're an investment firm with billions to play with, you buy billions of the Dow stocks when it's low and then sell the Dow when and if it's high. You'll make hundreds of millions in profit. Now, I believe that it is very easy to make the Dow go down just by having the news media and TV financial shows spout negatives about the economy. Every time the Fed says they will cut back on their buying, the Dow goes down, and they have made this statement several times. You just wait until the Dow goes back up to a certain point, and voila, you make out. That's Mr. Isn't it time that we did something about this? This is Mr. Webster, this is his theory about what goes on there. I read this because I've heard this from other people, too. This is what people think goes on, the manipulation of the market.
Yeah, and I certainly can appreciate where Mr. Webster is coming from. Actually, I think we're all wired to conspiracy theories. I heard you talking about earlier about House of Cards.
Yeah.
My wife and are currently binging through all of that. Yeah. And
bristles with conspiracy.
That scandal on TV, we're watching that. There's conspiracies surrounding us everywhere. But I think what's most intriguing to me is if there is a conspiracy, the conspiracy is to make stocks go up, not go down. The central bank only in the last maybe 10 to 15 years has begun to incorporate the notion that the wealth effect of assets and asset inflation is a very important part of our economic story. And so after the market broke, the Fed has stated very explicitly they're trying to inflate and reinflate the economy. And many of the strategies they're using have not reinflated incomes, and they haven't reinflated spending, at least not that much. But what they have done is a phenomenal job of reinflating assets. And so this is not the first time. We went through this when Alan Greenspan dropped interest rates to very low levels and reinflated a tech bubble. Now we went through this recently where we dropped interest rates and we reinflated a credit bubble. And here we are again with investors wondering if we're reinflating an asset bubble once again. The problem with asset bubbles is when they burst, we now know what's happened. So if there's any kind of a conspiracy, it would be for those investors who would like to see asset prices realistically reflect what's going on in the real economy.
Right.
And that
You mean avoid bubbles.
Avoid bubbles. Yeah. And the fact is that our central bank has been very clear that their mandate has nothing to do with bubbles. And in fact, we've had several central bankers say no one could recognize a bubble and therefore that's not our problem. What they view their role is that if a bubble bursts, they would come in like a white knight and rescue the economy afterwards. That, they do feel, is their role. Other central banks around the world disagree about this dramatically. So I would guess that it's an interesting conspiracy in our favor. It's kind of like, Dan, when the housing market was skyrocketing prior to bursting in 2006 is when it began to roll over, that we would all be complaining that our house prices were too high.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Not going to happen.
But if you're Mr. Just the last thing on this, Ken, yeah. If you're Mr. Webster sitting and looking at his 401k, his investment, his retirement account, and he sees a fluctuation like that within a couple of weeks, a couple of days even, you scratch your head. What does it relate to? Why does it happen?
There's
a million reasons, right?
Yeah, there are a million reasons. And the prices fluctuate daily in a way that is random. And to try and explain day-to-day variations in stock prices is impossible.
But there's sometimes in history and in human events, there are reasons why the stock market acts the way it does. And so we'll get to that after this break, because
sure.
I wanted to ask Ken Solo about the crisis in Ukraine and Crimea. It's Midday Money. Ken Solo with us, Chief Investment Officer at Pinnacle Advisory Group in Columbia. Please call with your question about investing. 410-662-8780 is our number. Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Ken Solo. What were you going to say?
No,
what were you saying?
No.
Oh, you brought in, you were telling me about something you brought in, and I was referring to this chart you brought in of important dates in history and how the stock market reacted to them. Is that what you put together for us?
Yeah, well, I put together lots of stuff for
you.
Yeah,
I know. You got lots of data.
You are a hard taskmaster. Yeah. But what I did was I thought it would be interesting. There is, maybe not surprisingly, a lot of research done on how markets react to crisis situations. And it turns out I think most people would be very, very surprised at how little of an impact these types of situations have in a longer-term investment plan. So Ned Davis Research, which is one of our research providers, recently
Ned
Davis Research. Ned They're an institutional research provider. They did a study. They analyzed 51 previous crises since 1907. So you have the list there, and
right. It's
kind of fun to look at. But
let me tell folks, the range is from the panic of 1907 to the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. You were saying earlier you forgot all these crises.
A bunch of them.
It's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers, when you look at it, the average loss, if you add all these up, is 6.5% on the immediately after a crisis. The average duration of the top to bottom decline is 21 days after a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and the median duration, keep in mind the difference between the average and median for all of our statisticians is only 8 days. So the pain is pretty short. But when you look at what happens over the next 6 to 12 months, it's pretty dramatic. So return 6 months after these crises, on average, the market's 9% higher.
Hmm.
And if you go on average 12 months later, on average, the market's 14% higher. And if you look at the medians, it's even higher than that.
That's interesting, Ken.
Yeah.
I mean, I see things on here that could be construed as good events in terms of the stock market. U.S. invades Grenada, for instance. That's on here. Let's see. U.S. bombs Libya. Then we have the invasion of Panama, Then we have Iraq invading Kuwait. So, yeah, it is a mixture of things that could be construed positive, negative in terms of the market, in terms of the U.S.
Yeah, right? Let me make a couple points about it, though. Yeah. I thought you might find this interesting. So I went back in the Wayback Machine to last August, and I just pulled out a research report. I want to read this to you real quick, okay? It appears Syrian leadership may have crossed a red line recently by using chemical weapons against their own people as part of an ongoing civil war. While the U.S. has tried to avoid the trap of getting involved, it is now boxed into a position where the president must act or lose credibility. The situation is in flux. The facts may change wildly, but here's our best take. While a strike has not been launched yet against Syria, it seems increasingly probable that there will be some sort of retaliation by the U.S. Trying to guess the exact timing of the attack is folly. But the latest messages coming out of various politicians gives us a sense it'll be sooner rather than later. My point being that if you were to have taken your money out of the stock market in fear of this geopolitical issue, that in hindsight isn't even front page news anymore. Maybe right. It should be, but it isn't.
Right. Right.
You would have missed one of the bigger stock market rallies we've had in years. Last year, this was in August, so between then and now, probably a 20-25% rise in the stock market. So one of my points is that the emotion of the moment makes it very difficult for anyone to look in their crystal ball and calculate the risk. The second thing is, and this is something I always say, you have to be careful when you talk about averages and average data. If these events occur when the market is overvalued or when the market is overbought, the results are going to be different. And so you have to be savvy about this.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote down several bullet points that I suspect your listeners already know about the Ukraine. There's very specific
risks. I was going to ask you about
there.
That. Did you measure anything seismic with regard to the market and the crisis in Ukraine, Crimea?
Well, just some things that I think, like I said, I don't know if it's news, but, you know, the world has benefited from a peace premium since the Cold War ended. If we're going back to that type of an environment, it's hard to know how stock multiples would react. Some see very troubling parallels here to World War I, where there were miscalculations based on treaties, in this case, our NATO treaty. Europe gets 30% of their natural gas from Russia, and Germany especially is a big buyer.
Right.
So a lot of people don't know that it was only in the second or third quarter of last year that Europe came out of a recession. They have very slow growth there. So it wouldn't take much of a shock. Economists call these exogenous shocks, an unexpected shock to the economy to throw them back into a recession. We live in a global economy, so some of the high-flying sectors that have been doing really well, maybe this could be the catalyst to turn the market around. So when things are really connected, you have to be careful. Here's the rule that I would have for everyone. When these events come up, it's time to do what we call a fire drill. Okay, you have a portfolio policy. Everybody should know it. So if you're a growth investor or a moderate investor, whatever you are, this is the time to re-engage with how much implied volatility is in your portfolio. Hmm. You should be comfortable now. If you're a growth investor and the implied volatility is a minus 30 or a minus 40, then okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When you say implied volatility, wouldn't that depend on the crisis?
Yes.
Say one that might affect energy prices, one that might affect mineral prices.
Yeah, let me put it a different way. You should be thinking, if the worst happened and we had a bear market, how much could my portfolio go down in value?
Okay.
And am I okay with that? Am I willing to look through a market decline to the recovery on the other side? We just went through this. Can I sleep well at night?
Mm-hmm.
Can I afford to take risk down? What if I'm wrong? If I take risk down, and we had a situation like I just mentioned with Syria, all right, do I have some plan to get back in? That's why most experts would say don't take risk down. And instead, if the market decline, consider it the type of short-term opportunity we were just looking at. Those market declines, on average, and again, we're careful with that, it turned out to be a buying opportunity. So the one thing you would hate to do is have an investor who woke up one morning and they get their monthly statement from their custodian and their portfolio was down $15,000, and they're like stunned and horrified. Oh, one last thing. Whenever you're doing a fire drill, do it in dollars. It is absolutely horrible to do it. Don't say, oh, what happens if my portfolio went down 10%?
Mm-hmm.
No.
You want to see the dollar amount.
If you have a $100,000 account, what would happen if I woke up and it was down $10,000? That's a more emotional number, and that's what you got to, I think, connect with.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Ken Solo is back with us. He spent a lot of time with us in the early stages of the financial crisis some years ago. He's chief investment officer at Pinnacle Advisory Group, which is based in Columbia. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. A couple of questions have come in. Suzanne had a question for Ken, and we'll see if we can answer it for you. Go ahead, Suzanne.
Hi. Oh, my goodness. You are so on time. I just retired.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank you for having Ken Solo on the show today, because these are things I'm pondering right now. I just retired from the federal government, and I'm an offset pensioner, which means I'm going to have a lot of money taken away. And I have a variable annuity. The last time I went into a panic in 2008-09, I was convinced to take money out of my 401k, federal 401k, which is the TSP, and I put it into the variable annuity, which has not grown very much, but my federal 401k has, which is under my direction. I manage it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to figure out at this point, I'm going to need to draw money out of either the variable annuity or the federal TSP to live on, and in addition to my annuity and Social Security.
So you have a choice, Suzanne, you're wondering about?
Yes. So I'm wondering whether to draw the money out of the variable annuity and or to draw the money out of the 401k for the federal government.
Ken is going to try to answer your question. Keep in mind, Ken is not a financial planner.
But
he's an investment counselor.
It's like a general kind of thing. I mean, like variable annuities versus 401ks that are diversified and that people manage themselves.
What are your general thoughts on that, Ken?
Well, my general thoughts are, first of all, and this is for anyone that's listening, I would strongly encourage you, Suzanne, to find a financial advisor that could work specifically with you on these types of questions. If you don't know where to find one, you could go to the Financial Planning Association online. I'm sure they have planners listed there. Some will work with you just for an hourly fee and maybe spend an hour or two. I certainly can't give you financial advice over the radio here, but what I can say is that the moving parts of this have to do with, one, can you take your withdrawals without any penalties, any back-end withdrawals? Number two is it has to do with your own personal tax situation and how much or how little you should take from each of these types of vehicles. Sometimes annuities, depending on whether you own it in or out of your plan, have different tax advantages. So my general thought is, and this may or may not surprise you, maybe a little bit of both. There's probably some mix of both of those that might be optimal for you. But again, I would recommend that you find a financial advisor and let them work with you specifically on that.
Ken, I have a question. I'm kind of curious about something. The people and their relationship with portfolio managers, their stock guy, their stock woman, the person that handles their investments. What percentage of people are really engaged? And I mean engaged, like on the phone every week or on the phone more than once a week or once a month or once every 6 months. I mean, what's your general impression of that?
Well, I think it depends on the nature of their engagement with their advisors. So at Pinnacle Advisory Group, while I have matriculated from being chief investment officer to being chairman of the investment committee. At the end of the day, mm-hmm. I've been involved in our investment activities. But as a firm, we have 11 certified financial planners running around giving financial advice to clients. In the nature of our engagement with clients, they pay us a fee. in order to manage their wealth. And that's a very typical nowadays. More and more financial advisors are retained in that type of a relationship. So people are, the term for the folks who work with us are delegators. They're paying us to make these decisions. And you don't nearly get as many types of phone calls as you might get from someone who might work, let's say, on a commission basis, a traditional commission broker, or who's working on a basis where the client has to give them permission to trade their account.
Right.
Then you could get swamped with phone calls. I would hope, and the best way to manage that for all concern is for folks to set the rules that they want to have, the type of relationship they want to have with their advisor. There's a lot of people don't want to give up what's called the discretion to trade their account to another advisor. They want that control. They just want some advice. For them, I would suggest they call as often as they want to call.
If you have a question, say, about a particular sector, and I'm going to ask you about a few sectors today, get your quick take on these. Mm-hmm. You wonder if does your portfolio, is it reflected in your portfolio, or is it sufficient? You know, something, you got some information, you like how something sounds, you should make that phone call. Let me ask you about technology, general technology stocks and biotech specifically.
Okay, well, the first thing I would say is that nowadays, technology, the way we look at it in an institutional diversified portfolio, is the technology stocks represent 18% of the S&P 500. There's a gigantic sector. So first, let me draw my comments to all of those stocks, which is 95% of the tech sector. That sector is probably a very healthy sector. It is what's called an early cyclical part of the market. Technology is tied to the economic cycle. To the extent you believe we're going to have global growth, tech is a good thing to own, as are, by the way, consumer cyclicals and financials. So those are the traditional classic things. The thing about tech is that we had the tech wreck in 2000 to 2002. The NASDAQ lost 75% of its value. And companies in the tech business have been slowly recovering. And in this economic cycle that we're having now, corporate America has been slow to invest, as we said before. So equipment is getting older, and the term for this is CapEx, capital expenditures. There's a lot of thought that we're in for a new capital expenditure cycle, and that would very much benefit technology stocks, and they're actually fairly valued. A totally, completely different story than social media and the cloud companies that we all know. And I'd be happy I brought some
stats. Please talk about that. Why the difference there?
Well,
what's the distinction you're making?
Well, it is eerily similar. The way I would describe it is to the dot-com bubble in 2000.
You mean social media investing?
Yeah, social media.
That's the way it looks to me from the outside.
You need to understand what a mania is. Mania in stocks is always credible in the moment. And I jotted down, you'll relate to these. It's just a few stats, okay? 74% of marketers believe Facebook is important in lead generation. 40% of marketers use Google+. 70% desire to learn more. 40% update their profile information on LinkedIn. I mean, I can go on and on. Two-thirds, 72% of adult internet users said they use social networking sites.
Right.
Okay. So when you get this type of a mania and bubble, people will pay almost anything for companies.
You mean because they're using it?
Because they're using it.
Because they're engaged with it. It's not like copper.
Exactly.
Copper, which is in the dirt someplace in a foreign country.
Yeah.
This is something you use every day.
And
right?
The story is something we're all familiar with. So we were talking about how you use Twitter to promote your show. Mm-hmm. These are things surrounding us. It has absolutely nothing to do, though, with the economics of buying a stock. So,
hold on a second. I want to ask you this.
Yeah.
Because it used to be, you know, when I was a kid, here's some Coca-Cola stock. You like Coca-Cola. Here's some stock in a company that you like, a product that you like, right? Because you use it all the time.
Right.
It doesn't apply.
Well, let me throw a couple names at you. MySpace.
Yeah.
And AOL.
I remember that. Yeah.
Right?
Remember that?
We remember them. They're not here. Now it's Snapchat, WhatsApp, and Instagram.
Okay, because it's happening so fast? Is that what
you're
saying?
Because it's so fast. We don't know the businesses when... Twitter is worth $40 billion now. They haven't earned a profit. Facebook trades at 114 times earnings.
What's Amazon?
I don't know off the top
of
my head.
Amazon is some crazy price, and it hasn't turned a profit in, what, 6 or 7 years?
Yeah, right? We were just talking about that this morning because, what was it, my wife was hearing that Best Buy was worried. Some analyst was saying Best Buy was going to go out of business. You know, there were 18 social media IPOs since 2011.
Yeah.
Only seven of those currently trade over their IPO price. So you get companies like Demand Media was up 32% on their IPO day. A company called RenRen, I don't know these companies.
I haven't heard of these. Yeah.
Yeah, they were up 30% on their, they're all both down 70%. So
Ken Solo will be here for the remainder of the hour. This is really interesting. 410-662-8780. So if you were thinking investing in social media, a little bit of a, well, what is that, Ken? Some sobering information from Ken Solo. A short break on Midday. We'll come back. If you want to send us an email with a question, try midday@wypr.org. Here's a question for Ken from Henry in Fells Point. What would your guest's advice be for millennials who are just beginning to focus on planning for the future? I'll be 30 years old in August and have never been able to save. I've recently started a new job in the technology sector, and I think I'll be here for a while. What are your thoughts on penny stocks? As you can imagine, this seems like a very attractive option for people who might not have a very large income.
My advice for millennials is time is on your side. And that what's most important, A, is that you begin to save. That's number one. Number two, if you could save pre-tax in an employer 401k plan where they're matching you, that's incredibly important. Number three, as a young person, I would suggest that you see if you could find your way to paying less attention to short-term market fluctuations and taking a much longer-term view of what you're trying to accomplish with your wealth. Mm-hmm. And then four, I would, for me, again, there's three basic rules here for everybody. One is diversify your portfolio. Number two is diversify within the asset classes that you own. So I wouldn't be messing, this is just me.
So you mean like technology, biotechnology as well?
Right. In other words, you can own technology and biotechnology by owning exchange-traded funds. And so you're buying a basket of these stocks mm-hmm. and not picking up the risk that any one stock that you own might go bust or not too poorly.
That's an ETF in the trade?
Right.
An exchange-traded fund.
There are thousands of them. And
you like those?
Yeah, very much so. They have a lot of benefits. They're very tax efficient. They're very inexpensive. Hmm. They trade during the day like a stock. That's just where technology is taking us. So you could buy a basket of 40 or 50 stocks or 100 stocks, and they literally trade like any one stock, but you get the diversification of owning a basket of stocks. So here's what you give up, Dan. You give up the ability to have a big winner, to get that penny stock or that individual stock, that social media or biotech stock that's going to make you 100% next week. But you also avoid, what you don't hear about is the other 90 stocks, like I said, that were 70% below their right. IPO price. You can capture a great deal of an industry or a sector's returns by owning the basket of stocks.
An ETF. Exchange-traded fund. Yeah,
very much so.
Okay. So take a look at that. Here's a question from Walter, also by email. Does Ken consider taking dividends in cash as opposed to reinvesting as a means for withdrawing from the market?
There's a lot of theories on this, but the way we suggest doing this at Pinnacle is to establish a withdrawal rate from your portfolio. So there's a great deal of research on how to do this. Most of the research says the safe withdrawal rate would be 4%, 4.5% of a portfolio. So I'll just use $1 million portfolio because I can do the math. If you had $1 million portfolio, your first payment to yourself would be $40,000. And then the value of your portfolio actually doesn't matter from there. You could take $40,000, inflate it by whatever the inflation rate is, essentially put yourself on a pension payment. And over the next 30 years, the data is very clear. There's almost no possibility you would run out of money.
You wouldn't run out.
Yeah. And then the issues.
You would be withdrawing, but not really.
Yeah, well, the problem with that, and financial planners and the research is all over this, is that it's actually too conservative. To do a plan based on never running out may not make sense. So to your listener's question, I would just take a withdrawal based on what you need and then rebalance.
Let's take another question. This one by phone. Joan in Lutherville, thank you for holding. You're on Midday with Ken Solo.
Hi there. We are, as American citizens, very well aware of how the stock market, major players, the banking industry, the oil companies, the investment houses, all made out hand over fist while the rest of the country went down with the horrible real estate issue that occurred. And all this time, they've been making much more money and these the doubling of the stock market and so forth, while the rest of us are flatlining. If we really want to change this country's future, we need to put our money where our mouth is. We need to start investing, not in oil companies because they're very successful in the market, not in the banking industry, not in the investment houses. We need to start investing in what is going to change our country for the better, the environmental energy companies, the electric car companies, the water purification company. U.S.-owned businesses. We need to really stop complaining about what Congress is doing and selling us out time and time again because of their special interests and their multimillion-dollar bank accounts that they keep feeding, and start really putting our money where our mouth is. If we can take control of this country by affecting the economy, we will get change in Congress.
Thank you, Joan. Ken, what do you think?
Joan, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think the issue and the problem is, and I think you alluded to it, is that as a country, our level of investment is very low. It's been depressed for quite some time. We're a country where our policymakers have encouraged us to spend rather than invest. And in fact, when our spending, they're encouraging us to borrow. They've pushed interest rates to zero. They would like for us to borrow, which is exactly the opposite of what you're suggesting. Two types of investment. One is maybe you're referring to government investment and how our tax dollars are used in that type of regard. And there, I think there's a huge amount of agreement. At least I certainly agree that, you know, there's nothing wrong. Without getting into the politics of it, what constitutes an investment at the government level versus government spending, at least in my mind, the differentiation is what's productive. You know, things like infrastructure and those things that add to the productivity of the country.
Or research, scientific research.
Those things
are... the president from Johns Hopkins University in here a couple of weeks ago talking about the lack of money coming out of National Institutes of Health, and the sequester affected that in Congress.
Yeah, so I think those things... But as individuals, if your point is, as individuals, let's change the theme of this conversation. As individuals, can't we begin to invest in these things that will add? Well, of course we can. And in fact, all the themes you mentioned, whether it's clean energy or which was, I think, a big part of what you said, there are, yes, exchange traded funds where you can buy baskets of stocks just in clean energy. And in fact, virtually any one of the themes that you think are important to build our country, you can invest. The only thing that I would caution you is at the end of the day, we're trying to build our way, our wealth safely, and to do it in a way that's sensible, in a way that'll earn us a premium over inflation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes our emotions in terms of investing in things that we quote unquote believe in, they might be great themes, but they may not be great investments. So you have to be a little careful how you
go about
it.
But you're an advocate, obviously, of diversification. Diversity, so include in your diversity a look at maybe the green technologies, right?
Exactly.
David in West Virginia has a question for Ken. Welcome to our show. Go right ahead with your question, David.
Hey, Dan. Ken, I feel that the stock markets, although they're the only game in town, are unfriendly to small investors for two reasons, program training and hedge funds. And I just wanted to know what you thought about in the program training, why are short-term, very short-term interest rates so low that allow these people to steal a little bit of everybody's portfolio value? And with the hedge funds, they're so large that they act like the investment pools way back in the early part of the 20th century, and they passed some legislation preventing that, but they don't apply that to these the hedge funds that control so much money that they can move the markets.
Yeah, I heard a couple of different questions in there. First of all, David, I just simply agree with you that there is very little fair about what goes on in terms of how the markets are structured. And so the bad news is I really can't answer your question. I don't think program trading has much of anything to do with properly allocating resources to assets, which is a function of our markets. I don't understand what type of interest any better than you do, other than I suspect it's big money that protects that type of behavior. So that's the bad news. The good news is that, and this is what I tell my clients, that at the end of the day, you're talking about pennies in a trade. Okay, that for us, the system works just fine. For us, instead of being very focused on how the robber barons are stealing a cent or a half a cent or a quarter of a cent on the dollar, and actually it's fractions of cents on the dollar through program trading, we need to just be focused on our own savings, behaving reasonably and rationally in our own financial world, building proper portfolios that are diversified. It turns out that technology allows us to do some very sophisticated things very easily to protect our wealth and grow our wealth. So so that's what I have to say. The other thing I would say is what you mentioned about low interest rates. Interest rates are low, but they are very low, having very little to do with hedge funds. Our interest rate policy in this country is based on the fact that our central bank is absolutely terrified that we live in a profoundly deflationary world, and they are trying desperately to stimulate demand. And we can talk about whether or not that is folly, but there you go.
Ken, one thing I didn't get to today was the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, coming up on the deadline for enrollment for the year on that. It doesn't look like we're going to make the goals that were set by the Obama administration or the administration here in Maryland in some states. But, you know, millions of people are signing up. I just wonder, generally, what's the feeling among investors about that whole thing, this law that was passed 4 years ago and the rollout of it, which has had stumbles, but is now definitely a part of our marketplace?
Yeah, I would characterize it as a huge amount of confusion from any number of different levels. So, for example, healthcare is one of the leading sectors this year, but I think it's pretty much being pushed by biotech more than, let's say, old pharma, those types of things. Mm-hmm. You and I were talking before we came on the air, some of the spending and consumption statistics are being a little bit distorted here as we're beginning to see things like transfer payments, Medicare transfer payments, consumer spending beginning to hook up, which is a good thing, but it's being hooked up by consumers that may or may not have been aware of the actual costs of this new insurance that they're getting.
Also, another thing driving that are energy costs, too, which are crazy this winter.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you are bearish, part of the bearish case is the Affordable Care Act is going to be a hidden tax on consumption. And once consumers better understand, which they don't yet, once they better understand this, they're going to cut back on their spending, which would be bad for the economy. Hmm. Whether that's the case or not, it's too soon to tell.
You're not sure then whether that's
going on?
No,
I think there's a lot of confusion about that right now.
Well, thanks for being here again, Ken. It was nice to have you. We should get you in here once in a while, more often. Ken Solo was with us several times during the financial crisis when the big bubble burst back, 5 years ago? More than 5 years ago.
7 years ago.
And 5 years now of the bull market. So appreciate having you with us, Ken. Ken from Pinnacle Advisory, pinnacleadvisory.com, which is based in Columbia. Thank you so much, Ken.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our first hour. It's just the first hour of Midday. Got another hour coming up. We're going to take a break here for lunch. Ken gets a nice lunch provided by Breathe Bookstore Cafe, serving inspired vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free savories and sweets and more. Open 7 days a week. They're at 810 West 36th Street, right in good old Hamden. Go to breathebooks.com for more information. Thank you to Breathe Books for Bookstore Cafe for providing lunch for our guests. Please stay tuned for the news, and we hope we'll see you for the second hour of Midday.